Welcome to Get Down to College Business. We will identify strategies that could make the difference between keeping university doors open and closing them for good. I'm pulling in business experts and higher ed leaders to debate the merits of strategies that could save the future of higher ed. I'm your host, Sarah Holton, PhD. Let's get down to college business. Hi, everyone. This is Sarah Holton and your host. I'm joined today by Dr. Malik Peter Khoury, the 11th president and CEO of Unity Environmental University in Maine. During his time as president, he's led efforts to transform Unity University into a sustainable, student-centric institution of higher ed. And he's focusing on three core principles: affordability, accessibility, and flexibility. As a result, he's expanded its programs while growing enrollment and national footprint exponentially. And that's what we're going to focus on today, is the growth at Unity and how the operating model has really transformed that university to be able to grow. Welcome, Malik.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with a couple of metrics that blew my mind when I read them. Unity's enrollment has tripled, and the annual operating budget has doubled in less than 5 years. Those are incredible accomplishments. What are your secrets to that?
I think at the end of the day, there is a passion and a hunger for education. And what we were finding out is that, especially in the space of environmental science, career-driven education, a lot of people out there really care about the environment and want to be in the green careers. However, what we found was, while our curriculum was what folks were looking for, its access and availability and affordability to a non-traditional middle to upper middle class family was limited. And once we understood that, we realized that we had to figure out a different way to design and deliver programs and courses to the, you know, over 40 million Americans who started college and couldn't finish, and those emerging new Americans and high school seniors who are looking for an environmental education, but the traditional model might not just be right for them.
So I really like what you're talking about, is that focus on designing and developing new curriculum that meets today's students where they are and meets more types of students. And I want to focus in on how your operating model is really the key to that success. And I know you've talked a lot about it on some other podcasts, the enterprise model that you've named it at Unity. And I know we could read about it on the website, but if you would simply talk a bit about the high-level benefits to this model, just to get us started on how it's really been the key to success.
Sure. If you think about a traditional system institution, there's a head system office, and then you've got all of these locations. Yet all of these locations basically are just duplicates of the same university with just differentiated majors and locations and geography and the like. We took that approach and said, what if we had an enterprise model, you know, a centralized area to really look at effectiveness and compliance and assessment, but separated these independent subsidiaries that were really designed pedagogically, andragogically, and even with P&Ls and student support to serve different kinds of students. Because if you think about it, asynchronous online instructional design, curriculum delivery, calendar does not need to look the same as a hybrid or residential program or a certificate program and the like. So we really looked at breaking our university down into 10 major functions and only applying those to the students that are the student audiences that fit it. So it gave us the flexibility to differentiate calendar, to differentiate faculty, to differentiate tuition prices, and really focus on who we are serving and what they need. And it gave us ultimate flexibility to meet students where they are.
So why was it so important to clearly differentiate between those units? Like, what benefit does that serve really in the end?
That's a very good question. I mean, if you think about it, if your instructional designers, curriculum designers, faculty, student affairs folks, and recruiters are discussing how to best serve an adult student, having that compromised with another subsidiary that is really looking at designing something for a coming-of-age residential student, or looking at something that's a little more expeditionary, there's always this need to compromise to the lowest common denominator. While at this approach, we really focus the product differentiation, the pricing, the services that we offer to each audience, allowing the flexibility that you can't do with a one-size-fits-all.
Do you think that also helps when you're using even short-term or long-term data to compare years and say, well, these are the units that are bringing in revenue. These are the units that we got to look at more carefully. Is that what it also does?
Absolutely. I mean, something as simple as cost of acquisition is very, very different for our online program versus our hybrid program, for example, versus our technical institute. But if you look at the national averages out there, you know, if you're recruiting locally versus you're recruiting regionally versus you're recruiting nationally, there's a differentiated cost of acquisition that goes with that. And when you try to put all of that into one umbrella, you end up compromising your ability to really reach those students that you need. So for us, it really was about, we couldn't treat the 37-year-old military vet father with three children and a full-time job with the same lens as a 19-year-old young man or woman who was looking for a more traditional experience and not understanding what it costs to recruit, what it costs to teach, what it costs to maintain the infrastructure, whether it's technological or physical, the differentiated services that they may need if somebody is coming to live on your campus versus you are helping them succeed within their own local community. It's really about a differentiation of how we deliver both the support and the curriculum. Even the faculty needs are different. Having a faculty member who is excellent at working with a student on an expedition, on a campus, or an excursion, it's a very, very different skill set than having some of our subject matter experts who work to create asynchronous courses. And putting them all in one big black box does not allow you to measure and iterate the best way to support your students and manage costs.
So when you're talking about the operating model, you described it as a centralized area to look at effectiveness assessment and some other structures with the 10 major functions. Are they all centralized? Do you have any non-centralized or decentralized functional units? And what does that do for how you work?
Absolutely. So the idea is this really healthy tension between what should be centralized versus what should be decentralized. And at Unity, none of our functions are absolute. All of them have centralized and decentralized units. And we actually have a structural integrity team and a president of the enterprise whose entire job is to constantly look at that balance between allowing our vice presidents for each subsidiary to move faster with decentralized policies versus needing enterprise sign-off for a centralized issue. So where we have drawn the line is if it directly impacts a student, a learning, or an experience, it has to be decentralized. So the vice president of one of our subsidiaries, they have their own faculty, they have their own staff, they have their own P&L, and anything that is deemed decentralized is within their purview. We as an enterprise at that point, our job is to make sure they remain compliant. However, things like budget, capital, accreditation, we need an institutional perspective. So we have that centralized. So a subsidiary, so we become our own internal regulators while at the same time providing maximum flexibility for those who need to go and create the programs and the services for the type of students that they are authorized to recruit, teach, and support.
I think that's so fascinating that you use best practices in education to create really how this is going to play out, right? That decentralization for anything that directly impacts students, but other types of functional units could be centralized because they can be, right? There's no direct impact to students. And you talked about that idea of a structural integrity administrator who's looking at that. And that reminds me so much of like continuous improvement projects. Is that sort of the origins of that staff position?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about this, we as an institution of higher education, we are supposed to be about continuous improvement. Yet we really take a very long time as an industry to make any changes. And our governance structures and our organizational structures really haven't evolved since the 18th century when education was really about the top 5%. And our job was to protect, not adapt. So this model was inspired because we needed to prioritize adapting to the shifting demographics rather than protecting. And in that, we had to build mistakes. We had to build errors. And so we needed an independent team through a matrix organization to be looking for that while others were able to move a little bit faster. And because of that approach, when we look at a venture that we start, let's say it doesn't succeed because of its isolation, it does not bring down all the other subsidiaries. So think about it as 10 life rafts instead of one Titanic.
What was the role of board governance in transforming the operating model? You spoke a bit about governance, and I want to make sure our audience understands what it takes at the board level.
Well, if you think about it, a lot of bylaws, a lot of governance structures were really designed to emulate the elite, the heavily endowed, and the heavily subsidized. And if you're one of those schools, maybe this model isn't for you. But if 95% of your revenue comes from tuition, should you really have a model that is designed around protecting resources that you actually don't have? And so our board had to look in the mirror and say, we can't be all things to everyone. And yes, we are fiduciaries first and foremost, but are we going to govern this organization as a philanthropic board that is whose primary audience are donors? Are we going to govern this institution as if our primary audience is subsidies from governments and grants? Or are we going to govern this institution where the student revenue through tuition is our primary revenue? And once we decided that, then we had to look at all of our policies, all of our structures, and realize that most of our bylaws were not designed to actually support that. And so we started to really put the student first and the need for adaptability in the first position. And so and that's how we changed it. So for example, we do not vote at Unity. We do not have committees at Unity. We have changed the structure at Unity to about role, scope, and authority, and basically task groups and working groups, where the dynamic shift is my job, who is in charge of that task force, is not to garner the vote, but instead to solicit the best ideas, to get the feedback, to get the information, and make a decision.
You just blew my mind again today. No committees, no votes, but you have a flipped model for decision making.
Yes.
I'm going to take a minute to absorb that. That sounds amazing. I'm guessing, though, that all this transformation came with some challenges. Do you mind walking us through some of those challenges as you're working not only at the board level, but also to implement some of these, you know, operational changes into the university?
I think the hardest part for us when we decided to go down this path was, who do we look to for inspiration? And higher education is very well known to talk about innovation. But anytime you want to do something, the questions are asked are, where is the data? Where is the benchmark? Where is the best practice? And the like. So how can you be innovative if anything you want to do, somebody must have done before you? So that was the first challenge, is this idea of we must innovate was not something that culturally we were able to absorb easily. Then the second challenge was cultural. Higher ed has always been the great white shark. We have never had to evolve. So the idea that we just needed better recruiters, better marketers, and more majors, and this problem would go away, was another myth that we had to overcome. The idea that we were the only game in town, because in the mid-90s, with the rise of the for-profits, the credibility of the community colleges, the alternatives to education, we in higher education sometimes were a little bit in denial. You also got the idea that all of us were built to work the same way. Committees, votes, social capital. And when we decided to go to a role, scope, and authority approach, even the best employees that we had did not have that skill set, because most of us came through academia, whether we were a student, whether we were a staff member, or we were faculty, we knew that's how work is done. So having to invest in training people in how to work in a different way, while the high sparrows of academia and other institutions who were keeping up with the Joneses were going, that can't be real, that can't be good, was one of the biggest challenges. It's like, how do you evolve when your peers and most institutions feel like evolving is somehow minimizing the efficacy of your institution? And for wonderful institutions who have grown like ASU, Southern New Hampshire University, WGU, so much energy was put in trying to minimize their success by many in the traditionalists in the academy. It made this a very difficult transition because I couldn't point to success that people accepted. And so we had to write our own rule. We had to invest in significant training. We had people very much upset about the changes. But because we were very diligent and very consistent and very disciplined, what was really fascinating is how many people you have within your organization and in other organizations that were waiting for a different reward system, for a different governance system, for a different evaluation system that aligned their success and their growth with the growth of the institution. And getting us to learn how to think about scale instead of capacity. Those were the challenges. Getting our accreditors, getting our regulators to see that what we were doing was within the standards of what they were looking for, just different. And that's when I got hope, because our accreditors, our regulators worked with us. And what we very quickly were able to teach a lot of our employees and potential employees is what we used to say were regulatory and accreditation limitations were cultural and policy. And once we started to have a few wins and we were able to absorb the, you know, that storm in the teacup that happened, we were able to make progress. And once that happened, we were able to accelerate.
I so appreciate how the heart of what you just said was changing the culture. Culture in academia, we know, is set up with very long-term established ways of doing things. And to break free from that, I mean, that's an admirable thing. And I'm sure it felt like an uphill battle at times. But now you're kind of on the other side, right? Now you're actually experiencing the growth. Have you had any challenges with such a rapid growth spurt? You talked about scaling appropriately. Have you grown too fast? Has that been a thing, or you are able to handle it with your scaling?
Well, you know, that is a matter of opinion. I know that because institutions aren't designed to grow fast, fast growth is viewed in the industry suspiciously. And so, there are challenges, because every time you grow beyond a certain level, your structure no longer applies, because it's just not about adding more people. It's about changing how you work. Because in higher education, we don't really grow fast. When we started to open a lot of open positions, people had the wrong idea that we were opening those positions in anticipation of growth, not necessarily because of turnover. So everything that we were doing that would have been viewed in another industry as success was viewed externally as, whoa, what's going on? So for us, the way we made sure that our growth was sustainable and scalable is we did not want to go from where we were to 10,000 overnight. We actually built at the beginning, because we were so small, at 500 student increments. And we invested for a structure and built out that capacity and took the risk of exposure, because this idea that you have to wait until your employees are overwhelmed to add people, it does not allow you to grow. So we always built our institution 30% larger than we could actually needed to allow for that growth. Once we hit 2,500 students, we realized that the next kind of point that we might need to do a restructure was 5,000. So then we built a structure to hit 5,000. Once we hit 5,000, now we are building a new structure for 10,000. And so that constant ability to adapt your structure, your personnel, your pay, like I told many of my employees, when you were the dean of a college of 400 students, your compensation and your staffing is very, very different than when you are a dean of a college of 5,000. But they couldn't see that, because everywhere else they looked, you were either in an elite institution or in a mid-tiered institution that really didn't grow more than 5%. So for us, it was really putting not time, but credit hour, number of students, number of personnel, and then starting to lean into technological infrastructure that allows us to scale. And I think that's the part that also folks need to know is you really got to build your growth trajectory like a ladder, not like a hockey stick.
Technology is often the tool for scaling. How has technology been used at Unity?
It is, I would say, the fundamental investment that we did pre-pandemic that got us to where we were today. I believe that if we had remained a tried and true residential campus and the pandemic hit, I believe we would have been one of those colleges right now that is either over-leveraged or closed. But because in 2012, our board of trustees had seen this cliff and we were looking, we started to invest in technology. A number of people have heard me say, you need to invest in technology today the way presidents from 30 years ago invested in facility. It is the new infrastructure. The other element was to create a design principle, because there are many institutions who are adapting technology, but every unit, every department, every school has its own CRM, its own IS, its own LMS. And so we really wanted to make sure that we had a prospect to plan giving a perspective on a centralized hub for all of our data that is managed in a very decentralized way. And so we adopted in multiple LMSs because we did not know which one was going to work for us. And each of our subsidiaries has the flexibility to do that, but it has to be fully integrated with our enterprise software, which is Salesforce. And so we are, I think, one of the first institutions to have a design principle from prospect to plan giving, all going to be built on the new educational platform on Salesforce. And no department unit can just have, like, advancement does not get to have its own data, while admissions has its own data, while the registrar. And actually, the investment in technology has been so beneficial to us for scalability that we just created a brand new function that started in July called organizational effectiveness, which didn't exist a year ago.
That's interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about how the organizational effectiveness feature works? Like, what is it measuring?
Sure. Organizational effectiveness is our center for systems thinking and operational excellence. So because of the Salesforce implementation and the need for our subsidiaries to use data in different ways, and for them not to be burdened with creating their own software and their own systems, we actually took the registrar, financial aid, bursar, enrollment services, business analysts, and put them under the umbrella of a chief organizational effectiveness officer to provide an institutional research services for all of our subsidiaries. And if you think about traditional institutions, you've got the registrar under maybe academic affairs, you've got the bursar under the business office. So it's a very, very different way to think, but it's given us operational efficiency, it's given us scalability. And while those other units, academic affairs, business office, the subsidiaries, still have authority, they have delegated the responsibility for scalable data management to an independent unit whose job is to create data that we can use to support our students. And you couldn't do that without a strategic investment in technology as the backbone infrastructure for the entire institution.
So speaking of student success as being, of course, the ultimate goals, I want to talk about student outcomes for a minute. So we think of a lot of the widely used outcomes such as retention and graduation rates in particular. I don't really want to know so much about the specific rates at your school because we could look that up. I'm curious what you think of using them as measurements for student success.
I believe that using those measures for student success is critical because for us, for example, them going to graduate school, them getting a job, their first career, them starting their own business or foundation, them following their passion are critical. We have had to kind of create our own measures of success, even though if you look us up, our comparisons are well above our peers for an open enrollment institution. But I struggle with the traditional definition of those metrics because I have spoken to many career services departments in my career, and they go, our job is to just help them with their resume. We do not take accountability. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not gimmicky in I guarantee you a job. But we need to make sure that we are giving students every opportunity for their next transition after Unity. So we have a full career services unit whose entire job is to make sure that we have partners and employers and graduate schools who are preferred partners with us for our students. So, and placement rates is really tricky for us because right now we are claiming over 90% placement rates of our graduates in their jobs. But to be fair, because of our audience are adults, a lot of them are working while they're going to school. So I don't want to act like that is some magic number because we are special, but I'm still proud of that. Retention rates is another one. Retention rates, when you look at iPads and you look at some of the traditional regulatory, really focuses more on first time, first year, and in many cases, residential students for those numbers. And a lot of times when your students are adults and transfer students and the like, they get lost in the shuffle. It's only a few years ago that some of these agencies have started to ask for transfer numbers, and it's always viewed as secondary to the real student. And that's what we're getting away from at Unity. You are a real student, no matter which of our subsidiaries you're in. And then don't get me started on graduation rates, where if you transfer in or transfer out, you are in a world where now we know there's documented proof that a student goes to 2, 3, 4 colleges sometimes before they graduate. That if you did not bring them in as a freshman and graduate them, somehow you did not, that student did not graduate. And up to 3 schools could be dinged because the student did not finish where they started. There's a, when I used to be in athletics, I used to kind of smirk when, for example, the NCAA would talk about how their graduation rates for the athletes on their schools are higher than the institution's graduation rate. Not too many people actually looked under the hood to see that the NCAA measured the graduation of that student no matter where they graduated from, while that institution lost the ability to say that student graduated if they transferred out. So there are a lot of idiosyncrasies in our data, in how we measure, that really leans to the medieval approach of education pre-1965, when we brought the freshmen for 4 years, we kept them in our ivory tower, and then we released them back into the wild when they were ready.
You mentioned that some of the most innovative ideas might not have that established data to look at. We might not have role models for who's already done it, so the best practices haven't been set yet. What types of data and information do you look for, maybe even demand, before taking a risk on something new, like a big project, a new initiative? In other words, how do you know when to lean in and act and when to hold off?
That is a fantastic question, because one of the conversations we're having now is if a degree is not the measure of success that a student needs, but learning is what a student needs for the next phase of their life. How do you, as an organization or as an institution whose entire measure of success is degrees, measure success? How do you unbundle? And how do you stop the, I would say, the cognitive dissonance that are you being skilled or are you being educated? Why can't it be both? What is the currency for the credential that a student needs to prove their work? And so for us, we still use all the metrics that are established by the accreditors and by the regulators. For example, the concept of full-time, part-time is a very interesting one. But we look at, for example, social mobility for us is a key. I was so proud of the fact that our team in distance education ranked in the top 15% out of the 2,400 schools in the nation about bringing in people, and then after they've graduated from us, are better. They have better jobs. They have better income. They have better opportunity. So social mobility is very, very important to us. Another measure of success for us is debt load. I am very, very proud to say that less than 2% of our student population at Unity take alternative loans to while they're with us to graduate. And if you think about the debt burden, wow. The idea that, this idea of placement, being able to see what jobs they had when they came with us, where they were in their lives when they came to us, and where they're going next, which kind of lends itself to social mobility as well, is key. So for us, the measure of success is the ability to give students access to education without overburdening them and their families, giving them the tools that they need, whether it's an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a certificate, or a unique course that they need to transfer to their school or get a skill. And is what we are doing, giving them value. And that's what we really look at. And one of my pride points more than anything is we have not increased tuition in 5 years, and we don't play the discount game. And, you know, one course at Unity, the way we've designed our calendars, allows you to gain full access to federal and state aid as a full-time student, as long as you complete 24 credits in a year.
I'm imagining that we have some listeners that are right now kind of inspired to blow up their own operating model. You talked about how it really allowed you to stay flexible and nimble and scale for growth. You talked about how it can lead to student success and what you count as success. So in your own mind, if you had some recommendations for those leaders who are like, I'm at this particular institution, I know I want to transform and make big changes, what recommendations would you have for those leaders to get started?
Know your governance structure. A lot of times, even boards will ask presidents to transform, but the rules in place really allow us to just be able to bring ideas forward. You understand whether you as a leader are prioritizing adaptability or tradition or protecting something, and do your policies structure align with that? I think a lot of times, if you look at the newspapers today, the moment a president or a leader tries to do anything, there is a national playbook about, I call it selective outrage. And once that happens, everything comes to a halt. Understand that that is going to happen, and what is your response? I think a lot of folks think that they're going to go from current state to desired state without the disruption in the middle, or the disruption is somehow controllable. Bring in outside help for you to understand that some of that outcry is manufactured. And how are you going to discern between manufactured outcry and real outcry? Do you actually have the authority to implement what you have been asked to do? Because the first thing I ever said to my board when they wanted to transform was, don't try to avoid the storm. Learn to dance in the rain. And that sounded cute at the time until the first major blow up. You don't need to be innovative to be successful. You need to be consistent. You need to be disciplined. You need to have conviction. Because if all you're doing is asking people what they want, what did Henry Ford say? If you ask people what they wanted faster horses. So sometimes nonprofits and higher education leadership isn't built to be able to handle, manage the change. And so the first position are boards and presidents to really look at what are they trying to do versus what they can do. And how are you really putting students first? And do you have the conviction, or are you only going to push as fast as rocking the boat? And once it's rocked, then you spend the next 3 months studying it instead of seeing it to the other side.
Those are phenomenal recommendations. And I just want to highlight a few of them that I captured. There was many of them, but for our listeners, in case they missed anything, know the governance structures and the policies and align them to where you want to go. So you have to have foresight. And I think that's a big part of visionary leadership, is saying, this is where we are going. And I have the courage and conviction to get us there. Knowing that disruption is not controllable, being able to discern between manufactured outcries and real outcries, knowing if you actually have the authority to implement or if your hands are sort of tied, not avoiding the storm, but dancing in the rain, being consistent and disciplined over innovation, and again, going back to that courage and conviction to be able to lead from strength and knowing how to manage change within your organization. Those are great recommendations. So Malik, as we wrap up, what's your best advice for college leaders right now in this era of transformation, transition, maybe even crisis for some colleges? What's your best advice for leaders to operate a viable institution? It could be related to the operating model, but it could be related to anything.
Stop telling everybody how great everything is until you get your consultancy and tell them it was really, really bad. That's what's happening. We as leaders spend too much time telling everyone everything is fine while secretly looking for jobs instead of saving our organizations. And then once we get that job, then look at the Chronicle, right? It's full of people who are no longer presidents saying how hard it was. Well, why didn't you say that when you were in charge, when you could do something about it? Why create a false narrative for the person who replaced you? maybe we need to just start being honest with where we are as an industry, because otherwise the world will pass us by. Because learning will always happen. Higher education is the best place for it, but not if our leaders are more afraid about their reputation than their students. And I will talk to boards that way, I'll talk to faculty that way, and regulators that way. A more subtle answer is, if you don't know where you want your institution to end up, then all you can then do is go wherever is the path to least resistance, right? Just by going. But if you have a target in mind, whether that target is growth, whether that target is exclusivity, whatever the target may be, and you are not a elite institution with all the money in the world, and you have limited resources, you really have to look at where you want to go and reverse engineer your processes to get there. Don't follow your process wherever it may lead you. And be radically transparent. You are in charge. Why are you afraid of telling people the way it is?
Malik, thank you so much for being here today. I'm sure some listeners are going to want to reach out to you, learn more about your school and your work. So I'll be sure to include your LinkedIn and your school website in our show notes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meg.
To support the cause of the affordable college experience, visit us at highlevelleadership.com. Read our blog and join our email list to get connected. Follow us and leave a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Let's get down to college business.